This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. When I say that, I mean men and sometimes women who were willing to put their lives on the line for the sake of us and our country's future. Each week we visit with World War II veterans. We want to honor them for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, boy, do we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired from these stories and by these men like Duke Ellington. I bet you never thought you were going to hear Duke Ellington on Hometown Heroes. Strike up the band. Where's the jazz? I don't hear it. Oh, it's not that Duke Ellington. It's a World War II decorated fighter pilot with over 180 missions. But that's what they called you in World War II, right? Duke Ellington?
You always get a nickname.
Yeah, and I guess if you grow up with the last name Ellington, at that time in our history, it was just natural, huh?
It was natural. That's right.
But your parents called you Ed.
Ed, absolutely.
Or did they call you Eddie?
Well, unfortunately, I grew up with Eddie, and it took a long time for me to get Ellington to shorten it to Ed.
Some people still call you Eddie, don't they?
Yeah, my sisters do.
Your sisters out here in Reedley, California, where we're talking today, and your niece, Patty Hickson, who's the general manager of the radio station that this program started on many years ago. So we thank Patty for letting me know about Uncle Eddie. She's been telling me about you for a long time.
I'll be darned.
And everything that she said was true, because I've read some of your memoirs, but I want to share your story with our audience today. And let's start at the beginning. You grew up, you were born on a ranch in South Dakota.
Exactly.
Is that your secret? Is that why you're still in such good shape and so tough all these years later? It's just the South Dakota thing?
Well, I don't know, but I was always active. I've been always active physically, so it's enjoyment for me. There were seven of us. I was the oldest of seven. I had two brothers, and Brother John was in the Navy. He was the most prominent one. He was very active in the Navy. He was a little short guy, but he was very outgoing and became the favorite of everybody. Mm-hmm. Brother John did. Dar was more inclined to be quiet, opposite of John.
Well, let's talk about you. So growing up out there in South Dakota.
Yeah.
What were your big dreams? What were your ideas about what you were going to do with yourself?
Of course, you know, as my age, I grew up in the very, very heart of the Depression. And so I was going to a teacher's college. That was a way of making a living. So I went to the teacher's college. I would have gotten a degree there, but the war came along, and I quickly went to war. After the war, I went back to Iowa State and got a bachelor's degree.
But before the war, this was Black Hill, what is now known as Black Hill State University in Spearfish, South Dakota, where you played football.
Yeah.
We just had another Black Hill State athlete on this show here recently.
Really?
From the reservation in Pine Ridge, Seth Irving. But you were maybe a year or two older than he was. But before you got to Black Hill State, your love for flying, or at least your ambition for aviation,
yeah,
was already there?
I didn't really get started till I got to Black Hill State, where they offered the training.
What made you want to fly? What was it about that?
Well, golly, you know, I think any young boy would like to fly. That was just a natural thing. And we had a nice little airport close to the college, 3 miles or so. And gosh, you get to fly, you know, and it wasn't going to cost me anything. And it's made my life.
I guess so. I wonder what would have been different had you not started flying when you were there.
I'd have probably became a country school teacher.
You think so?
Yeah.
I've got to ask you this just because I've never lived there, but I've heard a lot of stories from folks who did. How bad were the winters in South Dakota when you were growing up?
Oh, they were bad. I mean, 40 below was common.
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 Oof.
We even experienced 50 below, 50, 55, all that in South Dakota. But you grow up with it, and you got to have the clothes to go with it. And, of course, in the Depression, that was hard to do.
Sure.
But I can't say that I became immune to cold weather. I didn't. But, you know, you always found some way to dress for it.
Yeah. And there are so many military things I want to talk to you about. With 180 missions, I'm sure we could take days to go over this, but this is kind of fascinating to me also, because one of the reasons I do this show is to give young people, younger than I am, a chance to get a little perspective about what life was like back then and how well we have it now. Uh-huh. And I'm just thinking, if you're one of seven kids during the Depression in South Dakota, there are probably a lot of things you have now that you didn't have back then.
We were actually, the word destitute was what it amounts to, because the income became so slight. For example, when I was 14 years old, I told them I was 18 and went to the CCCs. Not 25 bucks went home and five to me. That's how stringent things were then.
Mm-hmm.
Just terrible.
And so folks who don't know, that's the Civilian Conservation Corps. So basically you were going to work. This is some pretty intense labor that you're carrying out as a 14-year-old just to try to help your family survive.
Absolutely. I was born to a pick and shovel when I went to the CCCs. That's what we were doing. We were building a dam, and the first thing we had to build was a keyhole for the concrete key. We dug a keyhole down well over 100 feet.
With picks and shovels?
With pick and shovel.
Wow. That's not easy.
No.
At 14?
At 14.
Everybody who hears this program is going to be sure not to mess with you, because they can tell already how tough you are. As far as aviation, you remember the first time you got to fly solo and what that felt like?
Oh, the first solo was out of Spearfish Airport in a Luscombe airplane.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, I had a very competent, attractive woman instructor.
Ah, little incentive.
What was her name?
Evelyn Sharp, right? I was reading your memoirs. I think it was Evelyn Sharp.
Golly, she was great.
Had you always wanted to be a fighter pilot? Because a lot of the guys, they tell me they went into the Air Corps, and maybe they end up a navigator, a bombardier, they're on a bomber crew, but the reason they got into the Air Corps to begin with was they wanted to be a fighter pilot.
Yeah, that's me. I wanted to be a fighter pilot.
Why? What was so exciting about that?
There was a chance that you could shoot down a German airplane, that you could become an ace. Of course, I never even came close. It was the excitement was of you in your own airplane doing the war instead of being the crew.
You had a little more control, in theory.
Yep.
I'm sure there are a lot of missions where you didn't feel like you were in control.
No. No.
And you got to fly just about every plane the Army Air Corps had at that time, huh? At least test out in them?
The fighter stuff, old P-36s were still flying,
mm-hmm.
and I got to be competent in the P-36. Then we had the P-38s came in, the twin engine, we got that. Then we went to the P-40s again. Finally, I got the P-51s. I had been through them all.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a favorite of all those?
Oh, the 51 by far. It had performance and acrobatic ability. I mean, it was versatile. And a lot of armament, 650 caliber. So the 51 was my favorite, although most of my missions were at P-40s.
Right, yeah, you had to stay in for a while to even get a chance to fly the P-51.
Yeah, that's right.
Because you were flying missions pretty early.
Yeah.
June of 42, you get assigned to the 57th Fighter Group.
Uh-huh.
That group's got quite a history, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And you're a big part of that history.
Yeah.
Were you eager to get overseas and do something?
Oh, sure. Oh, absolutely. That was a part of the game.
Well, and a lot of people don't realize, when they think of World War II fighter pilots, they think, okay, well, if you were in the Army Air Corps, you were flying from an airfield in England or maybe in Italy. They don't realize that the early missions in North Africa, that you had Army Air Corps planes and squadrons taken off from Navy aircraft carriers. You went over on an aircraft carrier, didn't you?
Went over on an aircraft carrier, yeah.
The Ranger?
Went over on the Ranger and flew off in East Africa, about at the equator. Flew across basically the equator, north up to about Nile River. And then we were based there for 2-3 weeks, and then we joined the British and went from there, from East Africa to West Africa, across the top of Africa.
But going over there, you don't know what to expect. You've never been through any of this before.
No.
And you're crossing the Atlantic on this aircraft carrier, the Ranger, and this is early in the war. There's still U-boats everywhere sinking American ships. Were you guys a little nervous that was going to happen to you?
Oh, we were constantly alert for the subs. that was happening all the time. The subs were a constant threat.
I know there have been a lot of people over the years that wanted to talk to you about what you did, because what you did was so trailblazing at the time. And I have some of the things you've written over the years, and it says on your journey over there, July of 42, as you put it, on July 4th, we had our fireworks, and I don't think they were celebrating our revolution. You said a German wolf pack was most aggressive, but so were our destroyers. So you guys had those escorts that took care of you.
Oh, they saved our fanny, no question about it.
But it also says here that you heard Axis Sally on the radio saying that the Ranger had been sunk.
Yeah, she determined us to be a goner.
Did you get a chuckle out of that?
Oh, of course. You know, here we are, safe and sound, and she's reporting that we're down.
And 70 years later, you still can't believe everything you hear on the radio, I guess. So, had you ever taken off of an aircraft carrier before?
No, no.
So here you are. This is 1942, so you're 22 years old. You're flying a P-40 off the deck of an aircraft carrier. Again, I'm reading some of your memoirs here, and you didn't have a whole lot of room there. And here goes the ship trying to keep it steady for you guys to take off. And it's going about 30 knots into the wind so you guys can try to take off. And you guys weren't sure you were going to make it off of that ship.
No, in fact, it was difficult with those conditions because you couldn't avoid going off the end of the carrier and going down till you got more speed. So you went off and went down till you were pretty close to the water, and then up made it.
So the slightest miscalculation or unfortunate blip in the wind or the weather, and you're swimming.
Wouldn't have been healthy.
Yeah, you wouldn't have had 180 missions. But you got off, as nervous as that was, and then you went and landed in Africa.
Yeah.
How different a world was that from what you grew up with in South Dakota?
You can only imagine a countryside boy getting into all this. You acclimatized. That's all there was to it. You became part of this thing, and it was okay.
Another thing I saw was that you, early on in these missions in Africa, you dealt with some serious vertigo.
Yeah, that's true.
That's got to be absolutely frightening.
Well, it is for a while. You know, no question about it. You don't know whether you're up or down, for one thing. I mean, you don't know your position in the sky. That's what it amounts to for a short time. You're just lost in the sky.
What snaps you out of something like that?
You maneuver the airplane in various conditions so that you come back to life again.
Those early missions, these are all in P-40s. You mentioned you're flying in conjunction with British planes. What were your targets? What kind of missions were these? What was the objective?
Oh, these were always against the ground targets. And then quite often, then we'd get into air battles.
So the ground war in North Africa is going on, and you guys would fly in these P-40s, dive bomb and strafe German forces. They're shooting at you too, though, right?
Oh, you betcha. Oh, yeah. You get hit too.
I've seen some pictures and read some of your stories, like about a wing you could stand up and stick your head through.
Yeah.
Tell me about that one. What happened there? How did that big of a hole develop in your wing?
Well, this was well into mid-North Africa when I was down low on the deck strafing. We were running against German 20-millimeter stuff. A 20-millimeter shell hit me right in the wing, and it put a hole in there I could put my head through. And it didn't fly so good after that, but I could keep on flying and land it. After I got out of the German area, I put it down.
How frequent was that, that you would bring a plane back from a mission and it was shot
up? Had holes in it. I experienced at least a half a dozen of those kinds of missions where you got shot by 20-millimeter or 30-caliber or something, you know.
Well, we need to take a break, but we'll hear more of those stories when we come back. If you want to see what this Silver Star and Distinguished Flying Cross recipient looked like then and what he looks like now, head over to hometownheroesradio.com. or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We'll be right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.